All right, welcome to the Greg Kelly Podcast. Thank you again. It's true, I am taking a little hiatus from Twitter. I'll explain that in a moment or two. Today, I'm talking to a true living legend. There are only a handful of people like this alive. Just being in their proximity, being in their physical presence, for me, is an honor, and I'm in awe that I had the opportunity. Clint Hill is a former Secret Service agent who is protecting on the Kennedy detail, the Kennedys, all the way up to November 22nd, 1963, when Kennedy, of course, was assassinated. You've seen the Zapruder film. The agent who jumps up on the back of the limo to shield the president and to make sure that Mrs. Kennedy doesn't fall out of the car, that's Clint Hill. I remember seeing these images as a child, and this was almost like looking at a picture of Batman. There was something mythical about this individual. And back then, you couldn't just find out who it was, what they were, you know, where they came from or anything like that for years. That was just a figure. And to me, it was, even as a child, I had to be 7 years old or younger thinking this is the reaction that order will ultimately prevail. As insanity is breaking out, that law and order will ultimately prevail. That's what he represented to me in my childlike brain, and quite frankly, still today, maybe a little bit childlike, but that's what I assigned to Clint Hill years before I knew what his name was. And anyway, I got to know him. He's had several books about his life and career and what he saw. We'll get to that in a moment. But first, I am really thrilled to be supporting a company called Freedom Fatigues. Please get to know these folks and their products. They are really great people. Have you noticed how many people are seemingly unpatriotic these days, refusing to stand when they hear the national anthem, turning their backs on the American flag, stepping on the American flag, burning the American flag? It is completely outrageous, of course, and we have to fight back. You know how I do it, actually. One way you can do it: start wearing clothes that were made from great American-made, veteran-owned companies like Freedom Fatigues. They have everything from hoodies, t-shirts, hats with awesome pro-America graphics and slogans, all made right here in America. You'll feel very proud every time you put a Freedom Fatigues item on. I know I do. I really, really like it. They have great slogans. It's very, very clever and interesting. Check out their incredible designs at freedomfatigues.com. That's Freedom Fatigues. We all know how to spell freedom, right? But fatigues is not necessarily a word you use every day. It's a synonym for military clothing, combat utilities. Fatigues, F-A-T-I-G-U-E-S, fatigues, like you're fatigued. freedomfatigues.com. Although we're not fatigued, we're fired up, right? And if you enter the promo code GK20, you will get a 20% discount when you check out, all right? freedomfatigues.com. Amazing people. Actually, I spoke to the CEO and founder not too long ago, an amazing individual. So stand up to the woke madness that is plaguing America and wear Freedom Fatigues. All right, now on to our guest today, Clint Hill, author the book that... All right, a couple of things about this interview. It took place a couple of years ago. It's true. But what he talks to me about is fairly timeless. He's talking to me about his career in the Secret Service and a little bit about what's happening today. And you'll notice it's dated because I ask him about then-candidate President Trump. So this is all the way back in 2016. 2016. My goodness gracious, this is 5 years ago. Well, this is when I, you know, it's hard to get a podcast up and running. But now that I'm in the swing of things, it's easy. But back then, not so much. I had to buy the equipment. I'm lugging it all around. I did these interviews. There was the sense that you had to do them in person. This is well before COVID. So I get myself to Washington, D.C. And quite frankly, I'm glad I did because I was able to sit in the same room as this individual, and this individual, Clint Hill, legendary Secret Service agent. And the book that had just came out was Five Presidents, My Extraordinary Journey with Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford. And it summarizes his entire Secret Service career. Now, one thing I should point, I think we start kind of mid-conversation, and Maya heard this recently, Maya Zumwalt, the producer, the executive producer. So I think we're speaking, it picks up mid-conversation, and we're discussing that Gerald Ford, when he became president of the United States, right after Nixon resigned, well, at that time, there was no vice presidential residence like there is today. The Naval Observatory on Massachusetts Avenue, a big government house that's well-protected and guarded and on government land. Back then, a vice president lived out in town, could live next door to you. And Gerald Ford did. He lived in a very suburban ranch-style home in Alexandria, Virginia. I believe it was at 514 Crownview Drive. I believe that's the address. And I've driven by it myself. It's an ordinary house. You would never look twice at it. But he was a resident there when he became president of the United States. And he lived there for a couple of days as president before he moved into the White House. Nixon leaves. You know, Ford could not move in that night. So it took about 4 or 5 days, whatever. And it's kind of extraordinary. And everything this guy encountered, so much of it is really fascinating to me, and I hope to you. So here is my conversation with Clint Hill. It's great to see you, and thank you.
Nice to see you again.
How has this book tour been going?
Very well so far. It's been very interesting.
You know, the book, I enjoy it a lot, and I was just telling Lisa that you have little, everything is, there's a lot of detail in there. I mean, and I am particularly fond of addresses. It makes it hard to read the book sometimes because I keep on Googling. I want to see 514 Crownview Drive. That's where Vice President Ford became actually lived as president for a while, too.
Mm-hmm. 10 days.
Actually, if you don't mind, I'd like to start there. That house is a terribly ordinary home, isn't it?
Oh, it is, very much so. And he lived there all the time he was vice president as well, because we didn't have a residence for vice presidents. And so when he was vice president, that's where he lived.
If you're driving down the street, I mean, it's I guess you would call it maybe a ranch-style house. It's just the
one-level ranch-style house. You can't get to it from the main street that runs by there. You have to go off because it's on Crownview Drive, I think it is.
And he, again, lived there as president. You know, we all know he was sworn in the East Room. You were in the room, but he went home to that place. They just weren't ready to move in at that point.
Correct, because Nixon had announced his resignation the night before. That was on the 8th of August. And then on the 9th, it took effect at noon, and he left the White House at about 10:20, 10:30 by helicopter. And then when he went to Andrews Air Force Base, got on Air Force 27,000. When he got on board, Nixon now, it was Air Force One. They flew west. When they got out about over Kansas or Nebraska, it was 12 noon, and the call sign from that aircraft changed from, "This is Angel, Air Force One," to, "This is Sam, 27,000," because now the president was no longer on board. And at that time, Gerald Ford in the East Room at the White House took the oath of office.
You became an agent in what year?
1958.
And by the end of 1959, you're on presidential detail. You are helping to guard the life of President Eisenhower.
Correct. And
it seems like you go from being kind of a, you know, a man on the street to a very sensitive position in not much time. I don't think it works that way anymore.
Oh, no, it doesn't. Now, when they become an agent, first thing they do, they apply. Then they go to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Georgia. If they get through that, then they go to the James J. Rowley Training Center in Beltsville, Maryland. If they make that, then they're commissioned as an agent. Then they go to a field office. They work investigations, cyber stuff, or just fraud, or protective intelligence for 6 to 8 years.
6 to 8 years.
Then they're assigned on a permanent basis to a protective detail.
I mean, Is that a better system now?
Yeah, I think it is better. The reason that it was the way it was before, under general civil service regulations at that time in the 50s, we were hired under what they called a Schedule C appointment. And that meant that we were somewhat of political appointees, although they weren't political. But that was the way to get us in the organization fast. So I came out of the Counterintelligence Corps of the U.S. Army, applied to the Secret Service. There were no openings because there were only 269 agents at that time in the entire world.
Yeah.
When the opening came, I left my job as a detective for Chicago, Burlington, Quincy Railroad and went...
You're working on a railroad?
Working for the railroad company in Denver, Colorado.
As an investigator?
Yeah, we worked on mostly theft from the railroad system.
People stealing stuff from trains?
Yeah.
And you did that after the Army?
I did that for, I was there about 8 months, I guess, before my Secret Service job opened up.
Let's go back. You were born where?
North Dakota.
And you were adopted, weren't you?
I was 17, let's see, 17 days old, and my birth mother turned me over to the North Dakota Children's Home.
Do you know why?
Yeah, it was in 1932, in the Depression. She had had five previous children. She had been married. Now she was no longer married. And then I was conceived. I don't know who my father is, because when I finally found her, she was 91, had a series of strokes, couldn't talk, couldn't communicate at all. So I never have found out who my father was. But then I was in that orphanage for 3 months, and I was adopted by a family in Washburn, North Dakota.
Can I just... Your mom, your birth mom, you tracked her down.
I found her in a nursing home in North Dakota.
When was that? What year?
1984.
Did she know of your accomplishments?
No, I don't think she had any idea where I was or who I was. Because they don't tell the person that turns over the baby what happens to that child, is my understanding. So she didn't know where I went and what happened to me.
So when you met her, when you told her...
Yeah, well, I told her, but you see, she was bedridden and had a bunch of strokes, so I never really understood or realized whether or not she understood what I was saying.
Right.
The nurse who was taking care of her all the time told me she thought that she fully understood who I was and that she was very happy.
And why did you want to find her?
Well, it always goes way back. When I was about six, maybe even five, the girl across the street in this town of 912 people where I grew up on the banks of the Missouri River told me that I was adopted. I didn't know what that meant, so I went home to my mother and told her that I understand that I'm adopted. This scared my mother real terribly, because she felt that if I felt that I was adopted, it would mean that I wasn't their child and they didn't love me and all this kind of stuff. And it really bothered her. So my sister, who had also been adopted, she and I are not biologically related. She had been adopted by this family about 3.5 years before I was. We agreed that we would never try and find our birth mothers while our adopted mother was living. And we didn't. And so she died in 1975.
But your mother told you, your adoptive mother told you something kind of endearing. I thought it was about your adoption and you being picked to be theirs.
Yeah, she told me that they had selected me. They chose me.
Out of all the babies?
Out of all the babies in the children's home.
So, all right, let's go forward a little bit. What were you like in high school?
I played football, basketball, baseball, ran track. Played in the high school band.
You were like a big man on campus.
I wasn't a big man on campus, but I participated in everything. I played trumpet in the band, and I was the first chair. And when I played basketball, this is a real small town, you know. When it had the halftime, we'd go to the dressing room, but I would have to immediately come back and get it played in the band while the rest of the halftime was going. And then just before the end of the half, I'd run back to the dressing room, go to the bathroom, come back with the team and play the rest of the game.
Where did you go to college?
Concordia College, Moorhead, Minnesota.
And you majored in?
History, and physical education with a minor in education.
And then after that, it was off to the Army?
Right into the Army.
As an officer?
No, I was enlisted initially, and I went through basic training at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, and apparently based on the tests, they selected me to go to the Army Intelligence Center, which was at that time was Fort Hollywood, Maryland, and they trained me to be a special agent in counterintelligence. It was a good training session.
Were you drafted? Was that part
yeah,
of the, you were drafted?
I had been deferred because of I had gone to college during the latter portions of the Korean War, and in order to be deferred as soon as I graduated, they just, it's your time, your turn.
So you're out of the, you learn some things in the Army. Your first brush with the Secret Service, you observe them, I believe in Denver at some point.
Right. President Eisenhower had a heart attack, and they put him in Fitzsimmons Army Hospital on the outskirts of Denver. And some of the investigations I had,
for the railroad?
No, for the U.S. Army.
This
was back when I was a special agent in counterintelligence, because that's where I also was working, out of the Denver CIC office.
Mm-hmm.
And some of my stuff was out at Fitzsimmons. And so while Eisenhower was confined there, he had these agents with him. And I was out there periodically, and I got to know some of them, or met them. And I really, you know, liked what they were doing. They were a great bunch of guys. And so then when I finished my service in the Army, I planned to go back and teach history. But I went back to North Dakota and Minnesota, and I went to a big variety of schools and locations, and I found that, number one, the pay was horrible. Living conditions were not very good. And I had kind of lost my interest in teaching history by that time. I was more interested in the investigative work. So I thought, well, this isn't going to work. So I went back to Denver, and I got a job immediately as an investigator in Denver.
So I think you were driving by the hospital, and you remembered the agents.
I thought, hey, those guys were pretty good. That was a pretty good organization. Why don't I submit an application? So I went to the office there in Denver, the Secret Service. It's a real small office, and submitted an application.
The railroad was, you knew you weren't going to be there for long.
Yeah, but that was just temporary.
And we talked about this before, from application submission to you're hired was, actually that took a couple of months.
Well, it was more than that, because I would say it was at least 8 months.
But once you're hired, does everybody go to the White House?
No, that was what the Schedule C required back then. That within the first year of your employment, you had to go to the White House for at least 30-day assignment. So that became our evaluation time. They would send me back, or us, whoever was the agent, back to the White House to work with the White House detail for 30 days. They would evaluate you, and then you'd go back to your field office, and if you were the agent that they wanted, they would notify the headquarters, and they eventually would transfer you. And that's what happened to me. I got transferred back there on November 1st, 1959.
Do you remember the first time you were in the presence of Eisenhower?
Well, it was after November 1st, 1959. Well, it wasn't, because when I was back there on the temporary assignment, I was working on a detail with him. So that would have been the summer of 59, probably June or July. And he went to Canada. He went to the opening of the St. Lawrence Seaway. And the Queen of England was there. And I was up there with the group of agents on security.
Just his presence, was it?
Well, you know, everybody looked up to him because of what he had done in World War II. For starters.
Yeah, but did he have something special going on? Like I've heard when you see Clinton, he exudes something. You know, sometimes maybe Obama has the same thing. Did he have a special way about him?
Yeah, probably you'd say that, sure. Just some kind of he'd walk into a room when he was obviously in command.
But before you get to the White House, though, you spent a lot of time guarding, I guess, his mother-in-law in Denver.
At nighttime, yeah. We had worked there at the request of President Eisenhower from 7 at night until 7 in the morning. And it was two shifts, 7 to 11, 11 to 7.
Now, I want to actually ask you about the sandwiches that you were served. But before I do that, Secret Service, why secret? What's secret about it? Where does that name come from? I mean, what is it?
It was when they formed the organization in 1865, and I don't know if you know the history of it or not. President Lincoln had a meeting with the Secretary of the Treasury, because at that time the United States currency was being counterfeited like crazy in this country, and it was really devaluing the value of the currency. There was so much of it available and around that they had a real problem. So they decided to form an organization to counter that.
Right. Well, so, where does the secret part come in?
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
There was nobody ever told me what it meant. But all I know is that at that time when it was formed, that was the name they apparently chose.
Huh.
And it was selected, I presume, not by Lincoln, because he didn't get to do anything about it. That night he went to the theater and got shot.
Yeah.
That was the day that he and Secretary of the Treasury decided that they needed this organization.
And is it true that the guy who was protecting Lincoln, like, went across the street?
Apparently so. I don't know for sure.
But he went to a bar across the street. That legend has it.
Yeah, he was a D.C. policeman or whatever the organization was in the city at that
time. So when you write books and you have personal observations of the people you're protecting, mm-hmm. you're not violating some code?
I have never signed anything that said I couldn't write a book. But whenever I write anything, I send it to the director of the Secret Service and to his staff and say, this is what I've written. If you have any critical information to give me about it, I want you to review it and tell me if there's anything in there that shouldn't be in there. And so far, nothing. But I have nothing in writing that says I can't. But I'm very careful.
Sure. You're familiar with the Kessler books.
Oh, yeah, sure.
How do you feel about those?
I think they're terrible.
Why?
Because I don't think they're truthful. I don't think the information contained in most of those books tell the truth.
I mean, it's a lot of real gossipy.
Oh, yeah, it's a bunch of crap.
Can you envision an agent sharing that kind of information with an outsider?
I can envision some agents doing it. The top majority, no.
I mean, let's face it.
There are a few, probably.
But you do see things that these principals, do you call the person being protected is the principal?
Yeah, we call the president the boss.
The boss. But if you're guarding, say, the vice president, what's he called?
The Veep.
The Veep. You call him by their, okay. But you have code names and nicknames for him.
One has a different code name, yeah.
And you were Dazzle.
Yes.
You had your own. All right, so look, you had to get off that duty guarding the mother-in-law of the president, or was it an enjoyable duty?
No, it wasn't enjoyable, but it was something you had to do. And what we would do is, I was probably the low man in the totem pole in the office at that time, because I was a new rookie, you know. So I usually got the 11 to 7 bit, not the 7 to 11. So I was there overnight, and I would sit there and I would read some of Eisenhower's books that he had in the basement of her house. She had a kind of a rec room, and they had bookcases. They were filled with these pocketbooks that Eisenhower had read, all Westerns.
By the way, the mother-in-law, I'm sorry, what was
Elvira
her name?
Elvira Dowd.
Dowd. She died on your watch, or maybe the guy before you, but she died.
Her nurse.
Oh my goodness, excuse me. Yeah,
The nurse died.
And you had to, you had a situation on your hands.
Well, what happened was Mrs. Eisenhower had just been there, and she was on her way back to Washington. She never flew. I can't say that, but she almost refused, and she very seldom flew. And she preferred to go by train. So she was on a train on her way back to Washington when this happened. I knew that if word got out in the press that we took a body out of that house, they were going to assume it was Mrs. Dowd.
Yeah.
If that happened, she was going to find out by a reporter that her mother had died, and yet her mother hadn't died. So that's why I was very careful.
It seemed like it was very well managed by you. Let's jump back to President Eisenhower. It seemed like he played an awful lot of golf.
Yeah, he did.
Recreation was very important to him.
Well, he loved to play golf, but he also liked to fish. He fished for trout. He loved to hunt quail.
I got the sense that he was a little standoffish with the agents.
We were treated more like the troops that he had in the service. We knew our place. He didn't know us individually by name. He would just refer to us as, hey, agent, when he wanted something done. And we knew how to respond, but He was a great man to work for.
Does it make any difference? I mean, okay, standoffish, very formal. Vice President Agnew, we'll get to him. You were personal friends with him.
Yeah.
He knew everything about you, visited your mother, things like that. Is one preferable to the other in terms of the job, protecting the boss?
Probably easier doing it with somebody like Eisenhower, where you're standoffish and you don't have that personal relationship.
Yeah.
That's probably better.
All right, so one thing that is very clear in the book, you don't like Nixon very much.
Well, it's not, I don't know if it's a matter of liking him or not. It's just some of the things he did seemed rather ridiculous. And very risky. I mean, he took chances where he didn't have to, and he did things that were just, I thought, were crazy, like going outside in a really well-secured area into wherever the problem was for no reason at all.
It
accomplished nothing.
Well, look, he's got this demonstration raging outside. I guess, look, the Secret Service, they want the president to be ultra safe at all times. It means
that's the name of the game.
Well, it means less work and less risk, and everyone's happy. But the president has to get out there. There's a tension, I guess, really, between the president doing his job and being with people and your job.
There's a tension between anything political and security. It's like oil and water. They don't mix very well. But we try and do our job. We know what they have to do. And we understand that they have to be exposed to the public. They have to press the flesh. They have to go out and get the votes. We know that. We just like to do it in a very secured, well-managed way, not just off the cuff.
Yeah. I never heard that he took a commercial flight. He took a commercial flight. He didn't want to take Air Force One. I don't think this has been, I saw it in your book. I've never seen it anywhere else. Why did he do that? Tell us the circumstances of that flight. He flew commercial, I think, from the East Coast to the West Coast.
From Washington to Los Angeles. He was going to San Clemente. It was the day after Christmas. The plan was for him to go to Key Biscayne, Florida, by plane. But they decided to go to San Clemente. And it was him and Mrs. Nixon and Trish, I think, was Trish. And a couple of military aides, its doctor, and a group of agents. No press, because they never told anybody we were going to do this until the plane took off. It was a United Airlines aircraft from Dulles. And after the plane took off, then the press were advised that he had flown commercially to California. Now, the White House press office put out the word that the reason he did it was to show the public that he was willing to do that to save on fuel of Air Force One, flying all that distance out there, that it was a matter of fuel conservation, and it was at a time when there was a gas crisis.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that, yeah, he flew out there commercial, wonderful. And he saved fuel? No, because an Air Force plane was going to have to fly out there anyway to be available, because they do that all the time. And since he was in California, they were probably going to have to run shuttles almost on a daily basis to get him information.
Before we talk about Dallas, I want to ask you actually, well, I guess it's about Dallas. If you walk around in life today in America, I mean, you might casually hear two or three references a week to what happened in Dallas. I saw a Simpsons episode, you know, where they're making jokes about the events of that day, itchy and scratchy, and they recreate the killing of Oswald. I mean, what's that like for you when you get these kind of casual reminders that are part of now pop culture in a way?
Yeah, I know. I just kind of ignore those events, those shows of that nature and that kind of a story. And I hear a new conspiracy every day. So, you know, I just have to just ignore it, really, because I know it's all theoretical, not factual.
And let's get this out of the way. You believe that Oswald shot Kennedy by himself?
Oh, I've never seen anything to give me any reason not to believe that.
Just before we get into the details, so you're 32 years old, and you've got a pretty glamorous job, fun job. It looks like it's fun, or is it? It's also a lot of really hard work and a lot of time away from the family.
A lot of pressure.
A lot of pressure?
Sure.
What?
I mean, you're under stress and strain all the time because these people, you know, they're your responsibility. If anything goes wrong, you know, you're going to be liable for it. And they don't often do the things that you think that they should do, I mean, behave in the manner that you would prefer them to. And so you have to adjust what you're doing to what their likes and dislikes are.
So it was very much on the mind of agents before Dallas that something bad could happen to the president, even though nothing had happened. The last president assassinated was in 1901. McKinley, right?
McKinley, up in Buffalo, New York.
So that's 62 years. I mean, there wasn't, complacency didn't set in.
Oh, no. There had been an attempt in 32 against Roosevelt. The mayor of Chicago was in a car. He got killed. There had been an attempt against Truman in 52. So, I mean, things had happened. We all knew that. It was very possible. And that could happen on any given day, at any time, any location.
You write about this, and you've spoken about it, the guilt you feel, which I have a hard time understanding. I mean, you something happened, you reacted immediately.
But it didn't get there quick enough to prevent the event from happening.
You're the only one who reacted.
I was the only one who had a chance because of the way everything was set up. When the shots came in, the two agents on the right-hand side of the follow-up car turned toward that noise, which was back here. Myself and the agent behind me turned also. We turned this way. When I turned to my right toward the noise, I saw the president's car right in front of me. And I saw the president do this and then start to fall.
His hands up to
his neck. And he started to fall to his left. I knew then, oh, this was a shot. At first, I thought it was a firecracker. But because there was kind of an echo in that area, so I wasn't sure. But when I saw him do this and go to his left, I was pretty sure that it was a shot. And so I jumped and ran, because now I did that, but they didn't have the chance, because by the time they turned back and saw I was already almost there, they couldn't make it.
All right. I mean, compared to the actions, I mean, the driver, God bless him, but he, in a confused state, slowed down. I mean, compared to the other...
What he did was he tapped the brake. He thought, when he heard the first gunshot, he thought he had a blowout. So he tapped the brake with his foot, with his left foot. And if you watch the Zapruder film real close, you'll see the taillights come on just briefly. And that's what that is.
Can I ask you about, and you wrote about this in the book, the night before, you get off duty at 1 in the morning?
About 1, yeah.
You're exhausted. You haven't eaten since...
It's noon. We had a light lunch on Air Force One on the way in San Antonio.
So you're hungry. There's no food around. So you all walk over to the press club because there's word that there's a buffet for the reporters and there might be some left over.
Yeah, they invited us to go with them. Merriman Smith specifically, who was the senior UPI reporter, and he was a friend of all of ours. And he said, come on, guys, let's go over and get something to eat over at the press club. And so we went with him, and then we got there. The local press had eaten all the food. There wasn't anything left. So then I said, well, let's have a drink anyway. So we all sat down, and I had a scotch, and a couple of the other guys had beer or whatever they were drinking. I bought some cigarettes. And then the guy, it was a bartender, said, I think there's some food down at a place right down the street, and I can't think of the name of it, some other club.
The Cellar House.
Cellar, maybe that's it. And so we walked down there. Well, they didn't have any food either. So I left there and I went back to my room.
Did you have a drink there?
They had something called, some kind of a fruit drink. It was terrible. I didn't drink it.
So Chief Justice Warren, apparently, mm-hmm. when he found out about the drinking, he was upset.
Yes.
And some agents were disciplined, I believe, for drinking in violation of Secret Service guidelines?
Nobody was disciplined at all. Rowley testified to the Warren Commission and requested that no disciplinary action be taken, and none
but
was.
It was considered, right? Was it against the rules to drink in that situation?
Yeah, the rule stated that you shouldn't consume alcohol 8 hours before going on duty. And so, yes, I violated the rules.
And you talk about it in the book.
Yeah,
anyway. One thing that he says, he was wondering, like, could the agents, if they had more sleep, if they had an easier lifestyle, if they hadn't been drinking, might one of them have noticed what apparently some people in the crowd noticed, which was a rifle barrel going in and out of the sixth floor window?
Yeah, I don't think we would have. There were three windows, as I recall, open on the Texas School Book Depository, and we didn't see anything out of the ordinary in either any of those three windows. One of the windows we did notice there were two guys or three guys in that general area, and it turned out they were painters or something from working in the building, and were having a lunch break and came out and got in the window to see if they could see the president go by. But the windows had been open on the buildings all the way up and down Main Street, so that wasn't surprising at all. But insofar as somebody seeing a rifle, I question that, because I don't think that Oswald would have been dumb enough to put the rifle in that kind of position. If you ever went up there and looked, the way he had set that thing up, he had a bunch of boxes behind where he was, and then he had a box or two that he could sit on, and then the rifle just rested on the windowsill. It didn't have to stick the barrel outside the window. It had the window up, that far, I suppose. And because of the positioning he was in and the way that building sat, the way the street went away from it, you ever been there?
I have.
It's not very far from there to the first point of impact. And he didn't have to do anything except raise the rifle. Didn't have to go this way,
right. Just
raise it.
So I want to be clear. I think you're
sure.
A hero. And somebody who runs into a kill zone, essentially, like that. I've been in combat. It's very difficult to run toward enemy fire. But the guilt that you have talked about and that you've written about, it's associated with your response time, not anything you did the night before or what Chief Justice Warren's was raised could have been a lack of alertness among the agents prior.
No, I only had one drink. I don't think that affected me at all. And I really don't think I could have, if I'd have been affected by that drink, I don't think I could have reacted when I did or got there as fast as I did.
After this happened, you were commended officially by the Treasury Secretary.
Secretary Dillon.
And that's the only time the First Lady, Jacqueline Kennedy, met your wife.
My wife and two boys.
So did your life change immediately after, did everything change? Was there a kind of November 22nd, did you have a life before then and a life after then?
Yeah, pretty much, because from that point on, I was no longer really with the detail as an agent in the Secret Service assigned to the president. I now was with Mrs. Kennedy and the children, myself and my assistant. Immediately, all the agents went with Johnson. But then, on December 6th, she moved out of the White House. We went with her. We didn't go back. We weren't part of that initial group anymore.
But your reputation, I would imagine that it soared in the aftermath, that you were viewed differently by others. You wait for something like that, and nobody really knows how they're going to react until it happens. You react in the appropriate way, and in a heroic way. Did it elevate you in the service?
I don't think so. I don't think it made a change at all.
You know what? Actually, when did other agents first see the Zapruder film? When did you first see the Zapruder film?
Oh, sometime in 1964, I guess. I couldn't tell you the exact date, but it was after I was assigned to Mrs. Kennedy, because I stayed with her that next year, whenever it was made available, and I don't think we got a chance to see it until 64.
And the first time you saw it, your reaction was?
Well, I was surprised the guy that took it got that much footage, and it was shocking to see the president on that final headshot. And it's very deceptive, too, that headshot. You have to really study it to really understand what really happened. Because most people, if you see it, you're initially going to think, geez, there was somebody shot him from over the right-hand side. Because the way this wound just opens up, it looks that way. If you look at it today, I'll bet you that's exactly the opinion you'd have. But if you really look at it and analyze it, you have to look at the way his head was at the time shot came in. After that first shot hit him in the neck right here, down just below the neckline, came out here.
Mm-hmm. The trachea, essentially. Yeah,
but it didn't hit any hard surface at all. So, I mean, he wouldn't have been able to talk very well from that point on, but it would, surely was survivable. And then when that happened, he went down like this. And therefore, when he was hit in the head, it hit him back here.
Uh-huh.
But it erupted out here.
Mrs. Kennedy leaving, I've heard different theories on this. I've heard what you say. But you've said that she was, when she went to the trunk, it looked mm-hmm. like she was escaping the car, escaping the kill zone. She was actually trying to retrieve a piece of the president's head.
True. That's what she was doing, and she did.
She wasn't trying to escape, which I could understand someone trying to do that.
No, she was trying to gather up some of that material because there was stuff on the trunk from his head. And she had a hold of a piece of skull. And when she got, I've got her back in the seat, she said to the, she said, I have a piece of his, I can't remember if it was a skull or brain, in my hands. Not he was skull. But, it was just devastating.
4 minutes from that point to when you get to Parkland Hospital.
Roughly.
That's a long time. And actually, you don't really say much about what happened, what was said in the car.
Nothing was said, really. She said, made the statement that, I guess a skull in my hands. And Jack, what have they done? And Jack, I love you. And that was it. The Connollys didn't say anything. I hollered at the driver to get to the hospital. And Kellerman, who was in the right front seat, on the radio said, I think we've been hit. Let's get out of here or something. That was it.
Do you, I guess you, it's unavoidable. You think about this. Forget, put the book aside for a second. Do you think about this every day, that incident?
Oh, sure. It usually is something to remind me every day.
Like what? What would remind you?
A song, a story in a paper, photograph, some person in a conversation. I mean, I can't go anywhere, and Lisa will attest to this. We'll sit down someplace, and somebody in the next booth will be talking about either the Kennedy assassination or her or him. I mean, it's hard to get away from.
And certainly, I mean, it's 2016 and the decades after, sure. What about this? You definitely had, you say it in the book, we didn't have a term for it then, but post-traumatic stress disorder.
That's what it had to have been, sure, it was.
And how did that manifest itself?
Well, I was fine up until I left a protective detail, where on the protective detail, you are so busy and so physically active that I really didn't think about it too much. A little bit, some, but not a great deal. But when I was moved over to headquarters, I got a desk job. I became the Deputy Assistant Director for Protective Forces. I dealt with budgets, personnel, management, all that kind of stuff, logistics.
Like a 9-to-5 job, and you had time, more time to worry.
Yeah, well, I had time to think.
Yeah.
And the trouble was, I thought about what had happened in Dallas. Where did we go wrong? What could we do to not have had it happen? And this just consumed me.
And in the meantime, you're smoking and drinking a lot.
Well, at that time, I was smoking a lot, but I wasn't drinking hardly, well, some, but not very much at all initially. That really started a lot later.
At some point in the early 70s, you fail your physical.
75.
And you're how old at that point?
43.
And what's wrong with you?
They said I had, psychological trauma and some neurological stuff that they came up with. I don't know what the hell it was.
So in pretty short order, you're medically retired.
It was in very short order, July 31st.
And by the way, full pension benefits?
66 2/3.
Percent?
Percent.
Could you live on that? Could you raise a family on that?
Yeah, pretty much.
Did you get another job?
I went in such a deep depression, I couldn't do anything for a long time. In 1984, I did a little consulting work. And then in 1986, again, and these are jobs that were, agents came to me and asked me if I'd help them out. Well, the first one was to go to Europe in Paris and help them with, that was 86, where the chairman of the board of Chrysler Corporation was coming over there with his board of directors They needed some help, so I helped them.
And the depression, is it being out of, is it not being a Secret Service agent? Is it what happened in 1963? Is it marital issues? Is all of the above? Well,
the marital issues didn't really enter into it because our relationship was deteriorating so far, so fast, it didn't matter. The problem was the all consumed by the assassination and the fact that I no longer was in the Secret Service. That really affected me.
And what did not help matters, in my opinion, forgive me, I'm sure you agree, the 60 Minutes interview.
Well, that kind of was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Why did you agree to that interview? In the book you say you were just going to talk generally about your career. You didn't think that it was going to be, you were going to relive that moment. I mean, why else would they have had you on?
The reason that they called and asked me to come on was to talk about the two attempts on Ford, because this had happened just before this. And so then that's really what they talked about first, CBS. Mike Wallace did the interview. And we finished the interview, there was no problem. Went home, thought everything was fine. About 10 days later, or a week later, Mike calls. He says, oh, Clint, he says, we had some technical difficulties. We're going to have to reshoot some of this. I said, oh, really? I said, okay. He said, we do it at the same place, Madison Hotel. And, oh, by the way, please wear the same exact clothes that you wore last time.
Can I ask you, though?
Yeah.
Why would they have had Gwen in that interview if they just wanted your technical opinion on the Ford situation?
I don't know, because they never asked her any question.
Yeah,
they
she's sitting there the whole time.
But they never talked to her, never asked her anything, and she never reacted. She just sat there like a mump on a log.
This was all very tough on her, by the way. I mean, I felt bad for her on November 22nd, November 20th, when you showed up and the whole country was affected by this. You had a front row seat and you guys didn't talk about it. Well, she wanted to.
At first she thought I'd been shot because a neighbor came over. This is right after the word got out that the assassination had occurred. There was word that an agent had been killed. And the neighbor came over and expressed his condolences.
Oh,
and, you know, and yeah. So she thought initially that I was dead, but then she got a telephone call from the Secret Service telling me I was okay.
So I'm sorry. So back to 60 Minutes. She's there with you for that interview, and Mike Wallace asked you to kind of summarize or tell you what happened that day.
But the trouble is, see, that was the first interview was fine. So then when they came back, Don Hewitt came with them.
The
he wasn't there
producer.
The first time. Well, Don is a stickler for emotion. And apparently they took the tape back to New York on the first interview, showed it to Don. He said, you didn't get what I want. We're going to do it again. So when they came back the second time, we sat down. We had lunch first. Mike and I shared a steak tartare. Then we went in and sat down, same room, same everything. First question was Dallas, right out of the box. So what had happened is when they went back to New York, Hewitt told Mike, I want you to talk to him about Dallas. And he hadn't previously. And so as soon as they did that, I just broke.
Have you watched it? how many times have you watched that interview?
Well, I saw it shortly after. I saw it when it was broadcast. It was taped. So I saw it. It was done in the late fall of 1975. And I saw it. I was really embarrassed. And then I got a telephone call from my sister, and she lived out in North Dakota, and she was crying because she had seen it too. And then I started getting some messages from people. They felt so sorry for me and all this. And I wasn't seeking sorrow or support. I just wanted to forget the whole damn thing.
And but half the country was watching 60 Minutes in those days.
Well, it was the number one rated show apparently that they'd ever had. So at that time.
Other than people calling you up and expressing sympathy, what were the ramifications of that interview?
Well, then that's when I really started drinking. Just because I couldn't sleep, I couldn't do anything. And I just self-medicated myself with alcohol, with scotch. And it just got worse and worse and worse. I couldn't hardly do anything. So then, that lasted for 6 years, 1982. A doctor friend of mine came to me and said, Clint, you've got to make a decision. It's either live or die. you keep on doing what you're doing, you're going to be dead shortly. If you quit, you've got a chance.
And
so I quit.
You quit drinking and smoking?
Both, same time.
You haven't had a drink since?
Oh, yeah. I drink a glass of wine.
Moderately?
Very. But I don't smoke at all. Haven't smoked since 1982, and yet I've got emphysema.
You look great, by the way. You're 84?
84.
And you're very active?
Quite. Your biggest problem I have right now is because of the emphysema, that sometimes I can't get enough oxygen.
And talking about these issues, or talking about Dallas, meeting Lisa, that helped you quite a bit.
Oh, I wanted nothing to do with her. The book they were writing, I didn't want anything to do with any of that. And the agent that she was, or former agent that she was working with, Jerry Blaine, got on the phone to me and said, Clint, you really needed my help, he thought. And he said, I'll make a deal. He said, you can edit or go through everything that's being written before we send it to the publisher. Take out anything you don't like. And I said, okay, I'll help you. So then he had her come to Washington in 2009. And Lisa was staying at the Hay Adams Hotel with her son. And we arranged to talk to her. I told her I'd give her 2 hours. And I went and talked to her. She said, how much did I tell you, Lisa? She went away, but the trouble is I made a mistake.
Gave her a phone number?
Yep. I gave her my phone number, and she was living in Doha, Qatar. And
that's kind of far away.
It is.
And, well, at least she was calling you.
Well, I would never...
Not collect.
Yeah. She did call about once a week for a while, and then twice and three times.
But that was therapeutic.
Well, it wasn't until she was so insistent, and she wanted to know everything, and she was really trusting, and it was easy to talk to her for some reason. Now, I had never told anything about the events in Dallas with my family, my wife, anybody, nor had I spoken to other agents about it, and they had not either. And now, in 2009, I'm telling her this story, and it became very therapeutic. I didn't realize it would be, but it was.
And for not talking about it at the time, I mean, people just didn't talk like they do now.
Oh, I know.
You weren't particularly reticent or anything like that. You were just kind of normal.
It was too painful to talk about it anyway. It hurt to talk about it. It really was that sense that, damn it, we failed. It shouldn't have happened.
I've had you for a while here. I'm just going to do 5 minutes or so, okay?
That's 10 okay.
Minutes, okay. Thank
That's
you very
okay.
much. So, all right. There was this kind of cute implication with the last book that there was something with you and Jackie, right? There was kind of like a little bit, no? We can take this out if you don't like it. But wasn't there an eyebrows raised a little bit? Like you guys had a very close...
We had a wonderful, close, professional relationship.
Professional.
No romantic things involved.
Did you see that photograph book? Did you ever see the book? It's called 4 Days. It's a kind of photographic retrospective. And there are stills of you... Mm-hmm. And, my brother and I, as kids, looking at that book, we thought you were like Superman. I mean, it was just kind of, you're kind of a mythical figure for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't just, we couldn't just Google Clint Hill and find out everything and watch an interview. You know what I mean? You were this guy in this book with the glasses. And has anybody ever told you anything like that?
Well, yeah, lately in the last few years they have those images like that and what happened in Dallas and my reaction. Many of the agents tell me that that's why they joined the Secret Service in the first place.
That makes total sense. It went, it was like sanity would prevail, quite frankly, that everything was falling apart. But this man taking this action showed us that even though it was horrible and chaotic, but that ultimately everything would be all right. I know I'm probably going to take all this out, but I don't know if that makes sense or not. But,
no, it does. I know exactly what you mean.
All right. So a couple of other quick things that I want to do, just a quick timeout. What was it about you and Spiro Agnew? you just liked the guy a lot.
Well, he was so down to earth and plain. And, on the aircraft we got for the vice president, when we'd go on a trip, it's a real small aircraft. It would be vice president, the doctor, myself, his secretary, and maybe 2 other agents. And we'd get on that plane. He had nothing else to do. So he'd ask to play cards, and I'd play cards with him, or the doctor would. And we got to know each other very well.
Have you seen Donald Trump at these rallies when he says, get him out, get him out, get him out? If you're a Secret Service agent working right now, and I know you say you'd take the job up again if you could.
I would, if I could.
What would you do after a rally, after Donald Trump was imploring everybody? He's not saying Agent Hill, take him out. He's just saying take. What would your advice be to Donald Trump?
To him?
Yes.
Well, I think that's not the appropriate thing for him to say. That remark is not beneficial. It's not helpful. It's going to cause a lot of problems.
Can I ask you then, why hasn't anybody in the Secret Service apparently told
they
him
may
that?
Have, but I'm not so sure he'd listen to
them
anyway.
The Secret Service speaks, people listen. People are, right?
Well, not always. Not always. A lot of times they just, if you recommend something or speak to them, sometimes they go the opposite direction.
Come over the quick things. Lyndon Johnson, when he becomes president, after the shock and everything, and was he carried away with the trappings of power? Air Force One, the helicopter. Was he kind of discombobulated by having all that, from going from the vice president, which, you know, you're living in your own house and you may have a car and a driver, and that's pretty much it. Then all of a sudden he had all this stuff to play
with. In those days. No, I don't think so, but he did enjoy those trappings of power, those things that were made available to him, and he made the use of them.
Getting at is this. I've heard this theory that I'm not endorsing, I'm not slamming Donald Trump, but in a weird way, he's prepared to be president because he's had the trappings of power. And from time to time, you have these guys who assume the presidency, who maybe they have had Secret Service protection for 3 months. They've never been on a private plane before, and all of a sudden they've got Air Force One. Does any of that make... This is way out of your expertise and mine, but can you see what they're getting at when they say that Donald Trump at least knows the trappings of power?
Well, sure, I understand what you're saying. And most of these guys that run for office like that, when they get up that high, they've been there and seen that and done that. But with Johnson, I know that he really enjoyed it because every president does. They love Air Force One. When they leave the presidency, that's probably the first thing they miss, is that aircraft and its availability and the plushness of it, privacy. Don't have to go through TSA.
Right. All right, just give me 2 more minutes. I want to make sure if there's anything else that I really wanted to...
Have you had a chance to visit 29,000?
Yes, in fact, I had a tour of it a year ago or so. I'm one of a group of people who were former special agents in charge of presidential protection. And we meet back here at the White House once a year. And in that last time we did, the time before last, they took us out to Andrews Air Force Base, and the pilot and the entire crew, including all the maintenance engineers, were there. I never realized how many people it took to take care of that aircraft. Yeah. And then the pilot took us up and walked us through the plane. And pretty nice. It's a lot better than the Columbine when I started with Eisenhower, which was a 4-engine Lockheed prop job.
When you went back to Dealey Plaza, did they know Clint Hill was walking around Dealey Plaza the first trip in 1990?
No. In fact, I had to sign the register when I went up to the sixth floor. On the ground level, they made you sign a book at that time. It was when I think it was the first period of time that the museum was open. You had to sign in. I signed a phony name.
Did you see a psychiatrist?
I didn't want him to know I was.
Did you ever see a psychiatrist?
Briefly, but I didn't think he was doing many good, so I just forget it.
If you had to go back, I mean, is there anything you would, what would you tell yourself? If you could give your 1963 self, December 1963, a couple of weeks later, if you could give that person some advice.
Sit down and talk about it with somebody you trust and that you have confidence in, and try and get it all out, because that's the one thing that helped me more than anything, is talking about it. I went back to Dealey Plaza in 1990. It was 27 years after the event, and that helped, but that didn't resolve the issue. The only thing that really resolved it was my talking about it and continuing to document it and then talk about it more with people. At first, I had a tough time. She'll tell you that we would go out and do presentations. I could never get through one presentation without tearing up and getting very emotional. Now I can, but at that time I could not.
Do conspiracy theorists ever hassle you?
No. It's funny, back at the sixth floor on the ground level, all these guys that are selling stuff around there, you know, know all the answers about the, and so I went and listened to him one day, and he stopped all of a sudden and he looked at me and said, "You're Clint Hill, aren't you?" And he picked me out of this group, and I said, "Yeah." He said, "Do you believe what I'm telling you?" I said, "No, because I know what the real truth is." And I turned around and walked away.
One more thing. Isn't it really strange that the Secret Service didn't buy a new car, replace that that limousine?
There wasn't any money to do it with. See, that's the other trouble. The Secret Service at that time, the budget or the money available was negligible. And that car we had leased from Ford Motor Company for like a dollar a year.
If the public knew that that was the same car, I don't think they would have stood for it.
Perhaps not. It was, you know, it was painted. Johnson required or requested it be painted black. It had been midnight blue. So it did change a little bit.
To me, when you're walking down Pennsylvania Avenue, I guess it's January 20th, 65.
Right.
Johnson is newly inaugurated or for a full term.
And I'm on the left rear fender.
In the same vehicle.
Same vehicle. Same position I was in 1963.
That sounds not post-traumatic. That sounds traumatic.
And the same car was used in 1969. And I was in it. Spear Wagner was in the back seat. Inaugural parade, 1969.
What was it? I mean, were you in another place? Was that, were you able to concentrate on the job at hand? Or was that had to be a very difficult position for you?
I just had to ignore that. I mean, really, I had to put that out of my mind, the fact that that was the car.
Anything else you want to get off your chest that I should have asked you?
Well, you know, there were some happy times too, but in those situations, some crazy things that happened. Like LBJ coming off the plane in a pair of pajamas and a trench coat to go shopping.
LBJ came off the plane in a pair of pajamas and a trench coat.
Mm-hmm. Christmas Eve.
Where?
In the Azores.
Man, that guy was just drunk with power.
Well, he had been sleeping. What happened was we were finishing, we had gone all the way around the world, and starting from Australia, then kept on going, Vietnam, Thailand, Pakistan, Rome, and we were on the last leg coming home, and they had to refuel in the Azores. Christmas Eve, none of us had any chance to do any shopping. So when we landed at the Azores to refuel, I told the people, the guys, and go ahead and go, because they had kept the post exchange open just in case. And so everybody left, except Johnson had gone to sleep and he'd in the bed, in the plane. And he had his pajamas on. So everybody's gone, and I'm down at the foot of the ramp, just me, looking around, and I, "Hey, Clint, where is everybody?" You know? So I said, "Well, Mr. President, this is Christmas Eve, and they've kept the post exchange open, so everybody went Christmas shopping." I said, "Hell, I haven't had any chance of Christmas shopping." He said, "Let's go." So now he's got his pajamas on. He reaches in the closet there and he puts on a trench coat. Down the ramp he comes. I grab an Air Force car and a driver. And I tell him to take us to the PX. So we go to the PX and he comes in there in his pajamas and trench coat. The employees, I mean, they were, you got to be kidding. They were just, you know, astounded. Here is a commander in chief, middle of the night, doing his Christmas shopping in his pajamas.
And one picture in the book, you're wearing a khaki suit as Lyndon Johnson seems to be kind of admiring you from the pool.
Yeah, that was something he gifted me. He gave me that suit. I didn't know I was getting it. He had had his tailor measure me about 2 weeks or a month before, and I wasn't sure why he had his tailor do that. I didn't know what was coming. And on this particular, it was funny, the day that package arrived later that morning. Nixon, who was a Republican nominee now, he had received the nomination at the convention, and Agnew, Dick Helms, Dean Rusk, and most of Nixon's staff, Ziegler, Haldeman, came there to be briefed by Johnson. So when they left that afternoon, I'm in the command center there, and the phone rings, and it's the president. He wants to know if I got the package. And I had received it that morning. I said, "Yes, Mr. President, I have that package. Thank you very much." And he said, no, he said, "I want you to put that on. Come on out to the pool. I want to see if it fits." So I put it on and walked out by the pool. The agents were giving me hell. You know, hey, here comes the Texas rancher, you know. And I go out there and, yeah, it looks pretty good. Make a Texan out of you yet.
But the first time you met him on the ranch, he had you pegged for a Kennedy acolyte. He did not like you.
He tried to get me removed. He actually told Rufus Youngblood, who was that senior agent assigned to him, to have me transferred back to wherever I could go. He didn't want me around him because he didn't think I could be loyal to him. And that's the one thing he demanded, was loyalty among the people that were around him. And so Youngblood went to him and said, look, he said, he was with Eisenhower, then got assigned to the Kennedys. He's a professional. He told me it was in your best interest that he'd stay here with you. So he finally agreed, and I did. And then that was in late 64. And then I gradually was promoted on up the line. And by 67, I was the agent in charge of presidential protection, the supervisor of his detail. So strange things happen.
And by the way, Nixon Nixon was obsessed with the Kennedys in an unhealthy way, one might say. He was very afraid of Ted Kennedy as a potential adversary, or he wasn't running against him in 72, I guess.
Yeah.
And he tried to spy on him through the Secret Service.
Yeah, he wanted an agent that he knew and the staff knew and who they thought would provide them with information to be the supervising agent on the detail. And I tried not to put him on there, but then I was told that he was just going on there, or I would find another job. And so we talked to the agent before we gave him told him he was going, and told him what the facts of life were, that if any information went to the Nixon or his staff about Teddy Kennedy, he was through.
This is Agent Newbrand, by the
Bobby
way.
Newbrand.
Now, they're talking about him on the tapes at length, and I think he's kind of cooperating with them. He told you one thing, and those guys something else, maybe.
He told them different things than he told us, sure. But I would bet you 99-1 that what he told us is what has happened. And Bob was he was a good undercover agent. He was full of BS. he's from New York.
Oh.
And he was really good, and he was in the Miami office at the time. And we called him in, and he was under the supervision of the assistant director for investigations, and they explained the facts of life to him. And 2 days after he was advised of this, he called back in, and he said, he talked to Jim Burke, and he said, Jim, Clint was right. They're trying to get information from me.
Last thing, what do you like to do besides anything related to the Secret Service or this project? What are your hobbies?
Well, I really don't have any right now other than write books, but I love the water, I love the boat and things of that nature.
And the two sons, I don't think we have that on tape. They are, you're very close to them now. You weren't so much when you're growing up, when they were growing
because
up.
Because I was never there, and it was difficult for them, I know that. Now it's... We're very close now.
Beautiful. Again, Clint Hill, thank you.
Thank you very much.
What a great American. What a really sensitive individual. I liked him a lot. And what he has seen, what he has done, and what he put himself through. Unfortunate. And remember, I think what he said, you know, if you go through something, you go through a trauma, talk it out, get it out. Don't hold it in. I don't think people hold it in as much as they used to. Maybe we let it out a little bit too much. I don't know. I mean, we've gone the other extreme. But I do think it's good to talk things out. And you'll notice I did not ask him about faith. Well, in 2016, I was still on a journey, early in my faith journey. And that was not the kind of thing I would ever ask somebody, in part because I really wasn't interested. And I really wasn't very far along in my own faith journey. So, maybe if I meet him again, I'll ask about that. I know it could have helped him get through what he went through, the dark times. And it obviously could have helped me get through some of the dark times much easier. Or, well, suffering's part of life. But I think there might have been more purpose. I would have realized that there was more purpose in some of the and some of the valleys than I realized at the time, had I been closer to God. But that is a journey that, well, you know I'm on, and I urge you to get closer to Him as well. What He wants, and He's waiting. All right, so I'm off Twitter. At Greg Kelly USA is defunct for the next 4 months because, well, you can go to my Twitter and you can read about it. I put a big statement out about it, and it's true. I'm working on something that's very interesting that I believe in. It was taking up way too much of my time. I enjoyed it, but I have to put it down for a while if I'm going to complete this other task that I must complete and that I am looking forward to sharing with you. So I had to shut something down, so I shut that down. And it's not shut down. I mean, I love Twitter. I know it's a whatever, but I love it. But it was taking up a bit too much time, and it's time for me to refocus on something else. But I'll be back, and you'll understand everything. So in the meantime, I'd like to say thank you again to our friends at Freedom Fatigues. These guys make American-made clothing with great pro-America symbols, graphics, designs, and messages on them. They are the opposite of politically correct, and I love these people. Good stuff, and I love their product, too. It's really, you know what I love? A cozy sweatshirt. A cozy sweatshirt with a message that might tick off the woke left. So go to freedomfatigues.com. Freedomfatigues.com. That's freedom. You know how to spell that. Fatigues, like you're fatigued, but you're not fatigued. FATIGUES.com. Freedomfatigues.com. Check out what they have. Great items, great prices, and we can do even better here. If you enter the promo code GK20 when you're checking out, put in GK20. There's a space for the promo code. You will get a 20% discount. All right? So I am pleased to share that with you. Pleased to support Freedom Fatigues. I'm buying stuff like crazy for people because, number one, I love their mission. I love the people, and I love their products. So I hope you check them out. And I think it's important to support businesses that, well, may not be favored by Amazon, may not be favored by big tech. You know what I mean? You know what I mean. So let's get in there and give some conservative businesses our business. So stand up for the woke madness that is plaguing our country and wear Freedom Fatigues. I appreciate you listening so much. To be continued, thank you. This has been the Greg Kelly Podcast.